Good morning, folks. I'm Sue Fultz. I'm a Center Service Specialist with CareNet, and I just wanted to welcome you to this leadership workshop, the new face of servant leadership. And so we're just so glad you're here. Just a couple of things. One is that when you have a question, when they begin to take questions, they will repeat the question so everybody can hear it and so can get on our tape. The other thing is I'll be giving you evaluation sheets. This year we're back to everybody asking everyone to fill out an evaluation sheet. And it really is important, so please do that before you leave and see that I get it, and I would appreciate that. The speakers are going to introduce themselves, so we'll begin in a moment. If it's okay, I'd like to pray for us. Father, Master of heaven and earth, we just come before you this morning to bow in your presence and give you praise and glory for this time here. We thank you for these workers in your vineyard. We thank you for these missionaries that take the gospel to those who are hurting and lost. And we pray this morning, Lord, that you will be with our speakers, that you will open our hearts and minds to receive all you have for us. Holy Spirit, we welcome you in this place. In Jesus' name, amen.
Good morning. How's everybody doing so far? Awesome. You can hear me okay? Can you hear Dr. Patterson?
Hello. Can you hear? Is that good?
So what we thought we'd do this morning, I don't know about you, but I'm just not a fan of talking heads. I don't learn well from them. Maybe it's my personal learning style, but I just like to talk. And me and Dr. Patterson, we like to have really good conversations, so we thought we would just have a conversation this morning with each other, but as well with you, especially as we consider millennials, a key talking point, whether in the media or otherwise. Is it okay if we sit? Is that going to be too much of a problem, especially for you guys in the back? No objections? Cool. We're just going to get comfy and have a little fun this morning, all right? Awesome. I'm going to introduce Dr. Patterson, because she...
You should probably call me Kathleen.
I can call her Kathleen, too, yes. All right, so I'll call her Kathleen. I'd love for you to meet Kathleen. Kathleen Patterson, she is a doctor of strategic leadership from Regent University, where she also serves as the director of the strategic leadership program down there, which I am actually a student in. That's how we got connected, and our friendship and our... just curiosity around millennials kind of was birthed. So I've had the pleasure for the last 2 years now, really just kind of sitting under her tutelage, her leadership, as we explored leadership. So.
Okay, and I'm making sure I get this right. Arthur Satterwhite is the senior manager of National Movements, and I love that. National Movements. And millennials are great at movement, so I just wanted to say that. But Arthur's from the Philadelphia area, and he was gracious in the introduction because I actually emailed him one day and said, what are these millennials? I don't understand them. They're so different. And he's considered an expert in millennials. And I wanted to understand them because I have three of them myself. And they're grown and out of the house, but they speak a unique language. And since Arthur was the expert, I needed him to teach me. So, and Arthur's been fantastic about doing that. So thank
awesome.
You, Arthur.
Hey, my pleasure. And I'll throw in there, I'm an expert kind of de facto because I am a millennial.
Yeah.
So there's some lived experience in this, but I won't take the... I won't claim that I can speak for every millennial. Actually, I'd offer that millennials, just as complex as they are, I'm an older millennial. I'm 32. A good colleague of mine, he's 23, and we have some very distinct differences because he's on the lower end of the millennial scale. But that's kind of what we're here to talk about today, to explore.
And we can't typecast millennials. Just out of curiosity, who in here is a millennial? Yeah,
we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about all that.
Yeah, and people don't even agree on the age of all that anyways. So.
I mean, even millennials. I don't know. Again, I don't want to speak for the others.
I'm not either.
Yeah. In some cases, we reject labels, including our own. So, yep. You know, it's kind of like one of those just kind of murky worlds that, you know, we'll figure it out as we go. Awesome.
Okay, first of all, we're going to talk about these three questions today. Who are these millennials? What is servant leadership? And why should pro-lifers care? So, Arthur, being the expert, tell us, it's almost like they're a foreign tribe to some of us maybe in the Gen X generation. I'm at the top of Gen X, maybe to the boomers. It's a mystery, a big mystery. Who are the millennials?
So it really depends a lot on who you're reading. In the academic world, they often use the dates somewhere around 1980 to 1983, all the way up to about 2000, 2002. But actually what you're seeing in a lot more of media today especially is that they're really limiting the millennials to those 20-somethings. You may have seen that in news articles where, yeah, those 20-somethings, they're crazy. They're wrecking the workplace. They're, you know, living on your parents' couch. You know, so it really depends on who you're talking about. I personally like to think that, especially when we look back at generational theory that prescribes, you know, a 25-year range, it's like almost 1980 to 2005. And again, there's overlap, like you said. My wife and I, case in point, we're both 32, but she identifies more with the Gen X generation, which is weird. So her parents are younger. Her parents are actually Gen Xers. My parents had me when they were older. My mom was 42. So my mom's firmly in that, you know, boomer, almost elder generation, but yet her, raised by Gen Xer, identifies there versus me as a millennial raised by an elder. I identify more as a pure millennial.
Wow. In our homes and in our workplaces, everywhere we go, in our churches, we have all these generations together. I know Pew Research has been talking a lot about how it's multi-generational, and if we don't learn to engage each generation for who they are, we might have a problem.
Yeah, it's especially in the workplace, there's been a lot written about it. It's the first time in, I think, history, according to a lot of the data, that you've had not just four, but really almost five now generations coexisting together. Usually it's been about three, but again, first time for four, but definitely for five. And to begin to navigate the drastic differences between, you know, the greatest generation, the elders, lived through the World War, went through all of that, all the way down to even the generation after me, Gen Z, we're calling them right now because we just don't know what to call them yet.
There's no other letters left after
exactly.
that.
So. We're gonna, you know, Gen AA next
right.
week. But yeah, it's just how do you navigate the distinct world views that have been shaped by clearly different time periods. Again, elders, World War, you know, going through that, the Depression, living through all those things, you know, boomers in some ways, going through the Civil Rights era, living through a lot of that, you know, Vietnam War. I was reading this morning, actually, that was talking about, for boomers especially, you know, having come through the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, this age of protest. They were characterized, they were celebrated because of their youngness. To go from that, again, to Gen Xers, where you guys were the rebels. You guys just rebelled everything.
Of course we did.
and then there's us millennials, you know, where if you were to listen to what the news says, you know, we're lazy, we're narcissistic, we sit at home,
entitled.
We're coddled, entitled, you know, we've got a trophy for everything, even if we didn't go.
Stickers, gold stars.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are the stereotypes that have come to you know, characterize generations that one can only imagine when all of that mesh mosh of stuff gets into the workplace, especially together, it just throws everything up in the air.
It does. I know I was reading some Pew Research a few weeks ago, and it was showing that the year of 2015 was the year millennials arrived on the scene in the workplace. And it was interesting because they were calling my generation, the Xers, the sandwiched group, because we're kind of sandwiched in between the boomers and the millennials. I found this incredibly interesting about the baby boomers. They were calling them a knowledge drain because they were having such a complicated time dealing with the millennials who maybe do feel this entitled, narcissistic personality kinds of things. But boomers were saying, hey, you want to be that way? We're taking our knowledge with us.
Mm-hmm.
If you won't hear from us and listen to us, we're going. And there's this big phenomenon called knowledge drain where they're saying, okay, we're not going to tell you. We're leaving.
I call it the forget you drain.
Oh, that's so sad. So as a millennial, give us some advice on how do we engage the millennial who maybe is a little entitled from a perspective of a boomer or maybe even an ex.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, in many ways, some of the disconnect is that we're just having the wrong conversations. We're asking the wrong questions. There's truth to some of what, you know, people say about millennials. Yeah, we're confident. We believe in ourselves. Thanks, Mom, Dad. It's really your fault. But, I mean, it's a good thing. It's okay for me to be confident, for our generation to be confident. But, obviously, that can come off, and there's a downside to everything, right? There's, you know what, maybe we should listen a little bit more than, you know, just going out and doing. So I think it really starts with let's stop the polls and pushing each other into or assuming the worst of each other based on what the stereotypes might say, mm-hmm. and start just listening to each other. How do we engage? How do I get to know you as a person, as a Gen Xer? What does that mean? By the way, Gen Xers are like the true red-headed stepchildren. You know, you guys just kind of got like, everybody only talks about boomers and millennials, and then the Gen Xers are just lost.
I know.
But
we're the middle child.
The middle child, exactly. But, yeah, start with the conversation. Get to know, well, all right, so let's talk about, you know, oh, if you're confident, what does that mean? How can we leverage the good things about each other so that we can not only learn from each other, but we can begin to incorporate a bunch of that into the workplace? Case in point, if millennials are confident, which we are, how do we leverage that confidence to help them to maximize, to capitalize on what are they really good at? What have they nurtured in their short period of time on this earth? What can we learn from them in the workplace? Because big hit, you know, big reveal, millennials actually want to listen to. As much as, you know, we may not come across that way in a lot of ways, or at least we're not portrayed that way, millennials actually want to be mentored. The problem is I think it's the traditional way we look at it. It's even in the Bible. The Bible says, you know, train up a child the way that they should go. So we consider young people as being untrained. And that's just not how this generation fundamentally sees themselves. So it's like, okay, so if we consider them as a trained person, then it starts the conversation differently. How do we continue to build on that training? How do we feed into that? Because they still want that, but then also how do we learn from the training that they do have and what they bring to the table?
It's actually fascinating when you begin to think about the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The research shows that millennials will choose, overwhelmingly, if they choose a job where you're only making $40,000 a year, but they love that job, they would rather do that than work a job where they're paid $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So tell us why that is.
Yeah, I think it's partially a byproduct of, you know, what world events shaped the millennial worldview. You know, we lived through Enron. We lived through the Clinton administration and the scandals. We lived through, and that's no political statements or anything, but we lived through all these different things. We lived through Bernie Madoff. We lived through pastors of mega churches, you know, falling to scandal. We lived through all of those things. So it's really, we need to understand that as we begin to approach the millennial and consider, all right, what might they bring and how might that worldview interpret or lead them to react or act within our spaces the way that they do.
It's pretty incredible when you think that they'll take less money. So money maybe not be the motivator.
No, it's really, with this generation especially, who was it? I was reading it this morning. Pew Research, through their research, they found that in some ways, this generation of millennials, you know, some are calling them the next great civic generation. Not that other generations before them haven't been civic-minded, but because they care more about purpose than they do, money.
Yeah.
It's not their primary driver. It's, you know, how, if I'm confident and I believe that I can cause change, wide-scale, transformative change, my primary driver is not going to be how much money can I get making it. It's, no, I want to do this. If I happen to make some good money while I'm doing it, great. But my concern is, hey, if human trafficking is an issue, I can solve that. I can build the organization that can stop it. I can go into the deepest, darkest places, and I can pull those people out. That's fundamentally how millennials, and I know we're talking, you know, very generally here, but that's what they believe. Poverty, global poverty, they believe can be solved in the next decade because they're going to lead the way to do it. It's not some ethereal thing that, oh, yeah, you know, we'll get to it, or it's way too big. No, we're going to stop this thing. This is done. That's the mindset that many millennials bring to these social causes and why money's not their primary driver.
Issues.
Issues.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
So a lot of the reading that I've done over the last few years on millennials is, and you mentioned this word, purpose. They're looking for purpose in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for a cause, a movement, something where they can benefit society. How do we tap into, as maybe pro-lifers or any type of movement, how do you tap into that desire that millennials have for purpose?
Yeah, I think it really goes down to, and kind of like the title of this thing, you know, how do we move beyond just engaging them and even empowering them really into how do we enfranchise? How do we give it away? You know, let's let them, you know, spark something new. You know, all the latest social movements that have been rising to the top, while they have been driven by women, so this is, you know, great opportunity, great space. But in a lot of ways, they've been driven by millennials, the Arab Spring, no matter where you stand on Black Lives Matter, all these different movements have been started by millennials looking to change what they see as something that's fundamentally wrong in society. And they're pushing through, regardless of what the media or culture or other generations, the critics might say, they're pushing through because they're like, no, I'm going to do this. I don't care. Come hell or high water, this ain't gonna happen on my watch.
That's kind of interesting because it almost plays on their sense of entitlement. Yeah. They really believe they can do it.
They do.
They do.
And again, that's the good side to that is that, you know what, they might actually do it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wouldn't we want them to do it? Yes, absolutely.
Downside to that is, you know what, because maybe they pursue it maybe a little too foolhardily, too a little gung-ho. Let's talk about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, right?
Oh, yeah.
That was comedic at some point. You know, people were on late-night shows, you know, they're laughing, you know, doing skits about this, and nobody took it serious. But lo and behold, 3 years later, you know, they just found a cure. the funding that was raised to that significantly moved the advance towards a cure forward. Like, there's a practical, tangible takeaway where millennials were like, yeah, we're not going to, you know, call us slacktivists or whatever you want to call us.
Does everybody know what a slacktivist is? Arthur, you may need to define that terminology.
Think an activist who doesn't have to be on the protest line. You can protest from your couch, essentially.
The selfie kind of.
The selfie, you know, yeah. I'm going to overcome this major game-changing social issue by pouring water over my head. Like, it's almost fundamentally opposed to what you think of when it comes to a protest, but yet and still, it's how do we think creatively? And I think that's where millennials are saying, look, you know, we don't, the ways that our parents did it, those were good, and they were well and fine for the time that they were, but the issues of today require something different. They require innovative, out-of-the-box thinking. And by the way, we've got technology. You know, we were the first digital natives of any generation. It's in our blood. So how do we leverage these opportunities not only to bring together communities globally, but to affect real change? But that's also why I think servant leadership especially offers a new way forward, a really significant opportunity to do something different. And I'd love to get your thoughts on servant leadership because you've been doing this through all of your studies. You've written tons of articles on servant leadership. You really helped to lead and shape, you know, building on the work of Robert Greenleaf and others. You know, what is servant leadership? And I maybe ask, one, could you define that? But then even talk about how does servant leadership different than just how we've thought about leadership for half a century.
Yeah. And I know some of us have more of a background in understanding leadership from a scholarly perspective or even from a literature perspective, but servant leadership is actually, for those of us who come from a Christian tradition, we recognize it obviously as a biblical perspective. And it is where you serve your followers. You lead them by serving them, and you are their servant first before you... I think a great way to really encapsulate it is your focus as a leader is on your followers. And that maybe sounds so intuitive to a group like this, but that's absolutely not intuitive to a lot of leaders. I've worked for fantastic, wonderful leaders who were great servants, but I've also worked for leaders who were absolutely self-serving. Has anybody worked for a leader that was very self-focused? I think we all have. But servant leaders say, you know what, my primary focus is absolutely not going to be on myself, on my star, my agenda, my ways. It's the organization, yes, is very important. I'm going to be focused on the organizational objectives. But my primary focus is you, my followers. And I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to seek your advancement. I'm going to seek your good. And it's actually based off a moral love perspective of doing the right things at the right time for the right reasons. And it sounds like, well, of course we should be doing that. But in the day-to-day of leadership, when we're managing ministries and nonprofits, it becomes very complicated to be able to live out that high charge of serving our followers.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's so good. Like we were just talking about, you know, generations. Like this servant leadership is a relatively new thing, especially when you consider, you know, the full. And we're gonna try not to get too academic here. But when you consider just, you know, how we as a people, and especially generations, have thought about leadership. As we look at the workplace, again, five generations exist in the workplace, each thinking about leadership in a different way. Can you maybe talk about like the differences and why there may be conflict in that?
Yeah, I mean, the most common leadership approach is transactional leadership. Mm-hmm. And that says, maybe if I work for you, Arthur, you say, Kathleen, you do this, do it today or else. And there can be punishment or retribution with that. Sometimes it costs a job or whatever. But there can also be a transaction can be used maybe in a good way, if you want to call it that, saying, Kathleen, get this done today. And if you get it done, we'll have a party. And so there's kind of an exchange process going on. It's a transaction. And I actually like, if you notice, that Roland Warren uses the term transaction a lot when he says we don't want to be returning transactions. And I love it because he's speaking this academic literature and he talks about not wanting repeat customers at the centers. And he talks about how we really want to transform people's lives. But we do that by serving them. We want to engage them for who they are as people. But to engage or serve someone, you really do have to know who they are and spend time with them. And I don't know, all the crisis pregnancy centers and all ministries are very different. You may have a huge staff to deal with, or you maybe only have one or two staff in your center. So it can vary based on your perspective. But I love that about servant leadership, Arthur, is it's not limited. And it also is not limited to your position. You don't have to have a title and a corner office or something fancy going on. You can even be a follower and serve upward. Maybe you work for someone who's a little complicated. We've all maybe done that. Yeah. But you can serve that person and serve them with greatness. One of my favorite things about servant leadership is servant leaders don't see people for who they are today. They see people beyond that. They see who they can be tomorrow.
That's good.
And for the greatness that they can become. And I think that's very interesting. Many of you have frontline conversations with clients. And maybe they're at a crisis moment or a moment where they're not really sure what's going on in their lives or they're doing. But one of the greatest ways that you can serve them is not seeing them for who they are today, but for the incredible greatness that you know that God's at work in their life and for who they can become tomorrow. And I love that because it really taps into the beauty of my favorite thing about God. Is it okay to have a favorite thing about God? My favorite thing about God is he's a great restorer. And I love that. And it's just been my testimony in my life throughout all these long years. So. Yeah. But it's wonderful. God is a great restorer. And servant leadership is really representing the beauty of that.
No, it is a beautiful picture. And I think it aligns so well, again, with who millennials are. Because I think that might be, if not the loudest thing that millennials are saying, one of the loudest is like, hey, I know that I'm not a fully formed person. I know that there's much more that I need to learn. The research from Pew that just came out pointed that out where, yes, millennials are probably the most stubborn optimists out there, partially because, you know, we believe that things can be better. But at the same time, and within that same thought, you know, we believe it can be better, and we believe that we have the skills and talent to make it better. But at the same time, we realize that there, in order for me to fully maximize who I am and to, you know, be my greatest self and to leave my greatest impact, I got a lot to learn. And servant leaders are postured to see the potential in other people and the people that they're serving, that are following them. I think that taps right in. And like you just kind of went there with the Bible and with faith, servant leadership aligns so well.
I know. I love that because we know Jesus gave us really the greatest example of washing feet. And in those days, that was, you know, like, oh, my gosh, you're washing the feet. But it's such a beautiful, beautiful picture. And I will tell you, I've been around the world with servant leadership scholars. And it amazes me the different faith traditions want to own servant leadership. And if we don't become strong servant leaders and if we're not truly serving well and doing this right, other religions, I'm just telling you, they will be glad to take it. They will be more than happy to take it. But I believe it's absolutely foundational to the Christian faith.
Yeah. And especially given, again, it seems like almost every day there's another article coming out talking about, oh, no, the Christian faith is dying, or, hey, we're moving towards secularization. Mm-hmm. This world's going to be without faith in, I don't know, what,
That's
2 years?
That's not true, right?
No, it's not true at all.
As long as there's people, there's going to be a God.
Exactly.
And there's always going to be a God. Let me
Amen.
Just clarify that.
That'll preach, by the way. But it's interesting, and I think, again, I come back to it, it's a prime opportunity. Rodney Stark, in his book, The Triumph of Faith, he essentially really debunks a lot of the Paul Revere's that are out there. You know, the millennials are coming. Oh, no, they're going to tear up everything. he kind of debunks all of that, and he's like, actually, no, we're not. You know, we're not going to, religion's not dying. Our major religious institutions may be struggling. That's real. That's very real. The data points mm-hmm. to that. But just because people, maybe nuns, as Pew labels them, or, you know, they're not self-identifying by...
Nuns as an N-O-N-E-S.
Yes. Well, there's also nuns, too. But...
I know.
No, they're saying, I am not affiliated with any faith mm-hmm. in particular. Well, if we really dig into that research, it's not as, can I say sexy? It's not as sexy. It's not as, you know, it's not from a marketer's standpoint. It's not, you know, that blood cell. It's not that big red flag to really highlight, well, actually, spiritualism, the people pursuing spiritual truth is on the rise.
Yeah.
The data actually shows that we're in one of the most spiritual ages in history, at least that's documented. Right now, we're living in that. So it's actually not a bad time. It's a good time for, hey, there's people that are looking for what we know God offers. And I love, again, I come back to the Bible. I love in Paul's letters where he's, you know, speaking to the Greeks and he comes to them and is like, look, you've got all these different gods that are here that you're worshiping. And there's this unknown God, the fact that you're seeking, like, hey, we don't know it all. By the way, let me introduce you to him. Like, that's the time we live in right now where we have opportunities like, hey, you guys are all searching. You're all looking. Maybe you haven't liked what you've seen on TV or you've heard in politics or whatever it is. Let me introduce you to the unknown God that you're searching for. And I think that's probably the biggest opportunity, even for the pro-life movement that is out there, especially with millennials, is, hey, they're not turned off to this. They may be rejecting the label, and not just the pro-life label. They're also rejecting the pro-choice label and all the other labels that are out there. They're saying, you know, the binaries that we have created, the social constructs that we continue to push in our, especially in our media, we reject that. It's not that simplistic, people. We're not that dumb. We think deeper. We think bigger. Like, give us credit and help us to really think that through.
I love that. We're actually, you've moved us into our next question about why should pro-lifers care about millennials? And I actually had a conversation with my oldest son. He's 27. And I asked him, he was talking about his job and where he was going in life. And I said, Brendan, what is the one cause you care about more than anything else? And he was like, you know, me and my friends, we really care about the pro-life movement. And I'm not just saying that because of you, Mom. And I love that because it's not just him, it's his friends. They have a passion for life. But it's not just life for pro-life. Tell us about the mind of the millennial with pro-life.
Yeah, I think, as I started to allude to, and as your son just kind of put out there, it's just like the loudest conversation that often dominates the discussion around pro-life and pro-choice, millennials are just like, they're like, it's got to be more than that. It's got to be something bigger than if I'm I'm trying to figure out how to say this. If I'm anti-abortion, then all of a sudden I am against women's rights and I'm against all these other things. Or if I'm for women's rights, then I'm obviously not for the baby. That's just not a true characterization of what they actually think. They know, and actually a good friend of mine, Dr. Charles Camosi, just released a book, Beyond the Abortion Wars. He's a professor at Fordham University, that from the research that he's done, it actually finds that the majority, like I'm talking 70% of Americans, they're a mix of I'm pro-life and pro-choice, at least how we, by what both of those
by
things,
definition,
by
that
definition,
they've been created for them.
Yeah, and especially millennials, and the good news is that the public policy is actually on the side of the pro-life movement and what it's trying to achieve, and it's millennials and Hispanics and women, mainly, that are driving those trends because they're saying, hey, I'm not for this abortion thing. I believe the science. The science says that, you know what, this is a human. And yes, we can have a conversation around, you know, human versus person. But again, that's the wrong conversation. Because by pushing each other into these poles, and this is, I think, firmly what millennials are saying, we're rejecting the idea that if you're not on my side, that you're less of a human than me. And I think that's what the conversation is often turned to, is where if you're not pro-life, you're a heretic, you're evil, we demonize, we essentially dehumanize the other side. And millennials are like, no, I mean, we can have some really strong fundamental disagreements, but we need to be able to wrestle with that and respect each other. Richard Mao, in his book, just lost it, Civility.
Talking
about civility, is just like we need to be able to, you know, have that respect, be able to really dive into these, especially social issues, deep, divisive things. But if we just stay entrenched in where we are and we don't ever actually begin to listen to what, and even more importantly, why the other person believes what they believe, how do we begin to address it? If I'm listening to you only to be able to poke holes in what you're saying,
argue.
Then we're not going anywhere. We're just talking at each other, or even worse, past each other. And I think that's the millennial mindset. It's like, I'm done having that tired, same old conversation.
That scares boomers and maybe even some Gen Xers who go, well, I'm right. And I'm going to stand for this. I'm going to stand firm and convicted. And they maybe have a little bit of a difficulty wrapping their mind around how millennials are really wanting to engage people in conversation so that people have a deeper understanding and it not be so much of a fight or an argument, but a conversation where things can be, hearts and minds can be changed, almost from an apologetic kind of view.
Yeah.
How do we really reach that mindset of maybe the boomer or the Xer what millennials are saying like that might be a little scary?
Yeah, I think, again, it comes back to us understanding or seeking to understand the unknown. The way millennials are going to pursue something, I mean, it's nothing new, though. Boomers did it when they were young. Gen Xers did it when you were young. You know, you threw out the traditions of your parents and, you know, caused chaos.
Girls and older wanted to do something different.
Exactly. Yeah. Flower power. How many people actually? It's like, no. Anybody that was older that wasn't a part of that movement, they were like, flower power, you heathens.
I know, right?
You're going to burn at the stake. But no, it's like, wait, hey, there he is. I see it. I see you.
My first word was peace.
But seriously, like, millennials are going to pursue these things. And yes, they're actually asking a question. All right, parents, you guys, you've protested outside of Planned Parenthood. You've stormed the steps of Capitol Hill. You've done all these things. How's that worked out for you?
You know what? That's exactly right. Yeah.
But what they're saying is like, all right, from my where I'm sitting, it hasn't really worked out too well. I'm not for abortion. I am for the baby, but I'm also thinking bigger. It's because it's a more holistic, a complex issue. I'm also for the mom. I'm also for, hey, this kid, if they are born, is going to have a full life. I'm concerned about the structural issues that may be coercing women to have abortions, but I'm also concerned about the structural issues that may oppress this child or this mother for the rest of their entire life. In that sense, I'm pro all of life, not just pro the baby. And if the conversation doesn't go there and doesn't leave room to have that open conversation to explore what does that look like? What else do we need to change? Dr. Camosi, in his book, he'd offered for our churches especially, if you have a pro-life movement or a pro-life ministry in your church and you don't have a pro-motherhood ministry or a pro-child ministry or
a pro-family
ministry or a pro-poverty ministry, if you don't have all those other things, then one, you're not going to see very many millennials sticking there. But two, you're not really pursuing a full, holistic, pro-life, gospel-oriented ministry.
You brought up the church again. Let's talk about the church. Roland, just a few minutes ago, addressing us as an entire group, talked about how a lot of abortions are happening in the church. Tell us about that, how that involves millennials, or really where should we be going with that?
Yeah, I'd say, and this may be controversial, I'd say that as a Christian community, as church communities, we almost, the moral majority was great for what it was, and it was necessary at a time. But unless we reconsider what these times call for us as a Christian community to offer this world, we're gonna miss the boat. I think Christianity, and this is not unique to the pro-life movement. It's across all these social movements. Any social movement, I feel like, and I think I'm in a room if I can say this, any social movement that doesn't have Christianity, a faith at its core, is not going to be effective. It's not going to achieve the full vision of what it's attempting to achieve. So I think for the Christian community especially, it's how do we get back to real discipleship? How do we get back to equipping a following of Jesus that is not only faithful and adamant in its convictions, but that's gracious, that's kind, that's loving, that has that comes back to the fruits of the Spirit, that has that just oozes out of us, whether we're talking about an issue that is very divisive, as divisive as this is. We can still have that conversation, hopefully led by the Spirit, that is convicted at its core, while at the same time gracious in how it is explored.
That it's interesting when you bring the power of conviction with the power of love together.
Yeah.
That can change things.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, tell us this, because you are so good at understanding movements and the millennials' drive for purpose, significance, that they're seeking to do. How do we tap that potential that millennials have that really do want to make a difference? They're seeking their purpose. How do we bridge that into a pro-life movement when they look at the pro-life movement as it is, as maybe ineffective?
That's a good question. I think it comes back to kind of like our title, how do we give it away? You know, and how do we give the pro-life movement away and realize that, you know what, they're not going to just toss it out of here. They're not going to just discredit it. It's not going to, you know, be shoved to the shelves or back corners of social conversation. Millennials are going to take and do with it something completely different.
Do you think boomers and Xers can handle that?
I think we have to. Mm-hmm. I think, again, this happens across every generation. There's a coming of age that happens, and there has to be a passing of the torch. And that has happened at different phases and different ages across history. But what we're seeing right now, I think, is a generation of millennials who are coming of age. It's not fundamentally beyond us to consider, you know what, not this presidency, but maybe in 2020, we could see our first millennial president. Like, there's millennials that are the heads of companies. They're CEOs. So this is now. It's not next year. It's not 5 years. This is now. So I think for boomers and Gen Xers, it's not, oh, they're going to kick me out and put me out of the pasture. It's, oh, I have the opportunity to really lead them as they really begin to tap into their leadership. And I think, and I love this imagery from Phyllis Tickle in her book, The Great Emergence. She paints this picture of history, dating all the way back to Alexander the Great, where essentially every 500 years is this great moment, whether it's the Great Awakening, Alexander the Great, all the way through. And she uses the metaphor of a boat tied to a dock that's being kind of moved around, you know, pushed around in the waves. And the metaphor is essentially that rope is the older generations. And that's keeping the younger people, millennials in this case, who are in the boat from getting lost out to sea, taken out to the ocean to be lost forever. It's keeping them tied firmly to their foundation, which is that dock. But two things can happen. You know, if the rope pulls the boat back too hard, it'll crash to shore on the rocks and get destroyed. And vice versa, if the millennials pull too hard, the rope will break and they'll lose their foundation and move out. So it's how do we, like, we need each other's generations. And instead of seeing each other as competitive, and I I'll speak generally, I think the often unspoken truth with the millennial generation is that amongst their confidence, there's great insecurity. Where, again, we want to be led. We know we don't know it all. We want to learn. But at the same time, we want to be a co-laborer in the process. We want to be seen as fully human, as fully partner. And I think especially for the pro-life movement, let's just get structural, organizational. If your organizations don't have millennials at the table in your leadership meetings, and not just the token millennial that you invited in to sit there and throw out a crazy idea, but no, they're fully contributive, maybe even has a leadership title and position. If they're not there, then you're not doing it. And you're running the risk of potentially either, one, not engaging them, not pulling them into it, but even turning them off.
Having a millennial at the table is important, and I know some of that outgrowth has been a little more attention to social media. Social media is here,
yes,
obviously. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of it. Maybe for some of us who aren't as comfortable engaging the social aspects of those technologies, what do we do?
Yeah, it's like the old mantra, everything in moderation.
There's
a good and a bad to everything, you know, whether it's stereotypes, there's some truth and not.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing when it comes to social media. Yes, there are trolls out there on Twitter. There are people who just have nothing but terrible things to say on Twitter. But that doesn't eliminate or discredit the significant opportunity that Twitter might play for your organizations. And that's not just Twitter. That's Facebook. That's Pinterest. That's you name it. Snapchat even. I personally am not a Snapchat
kind
person.
Of a newer one, right?
Yeah, you got to be careful with the masks. You know, it can get a little awkward. But now, seriously, you can leverage. Case in point, my wife. She has her own business. She actually is about to launch another one right now.
Cool.
I married up, ladies.
She's beautiful. Let me just tell you.
See, she endorsed. So she was telling me last night, like, just take Oreo and their Instagram page right now. Like, the way they use their Instagram to tell stories. They just share people's stories. Like, hey, you know, I was a child, and I remember when my mom, you know, pulled me up to the table, you know, after school and gave me a glass of milk. And, you know, we just sat down and we just talked. And, you know, there happened to be some Oreos right there. And, you know, we were just dipping them. Like, the power of that imagery and that story, like what she was telling me, I'm like, I feel like I need to go around the corner and get some Oreos right now.
I know, right?
That's the opportunity that social media has for us to tell our stories in unique and different ways, and to think differently. You know, the story doesn't have to be a 30-minute video. It doesn't have to be a 4-page, you know, position paper. It could be 140 words. It might not even be words. It might just be an image. And it's those things, I think, that'll shift the narrative, which right now is what is keeping younger generations, not just millennials, I'd even say the next generation behind them, from fully embracing the pro-life movement as it is. They embrace the concepts, they embrace the core beliefs, the fundamentals that the pro-life movement stands for. They're all in. You know, it's the label that they're like, I don't want to have that conversation. I don't want to be associated with that, because that'll limit my potential opportunity to actually cause positive change.
Wow. It's phenomenal when you begin to unpack who millennials are and you begin to unpack how we can lead them. But then when you begin to see some of this, you see the potential of really how millennials can change the face
of life.
Yeah.
And millennials don't look at pro-life as just life in the womb. They're looking at pro-life issues in a broader context.
Yeah.
Maybe from a prison. They're looking at things like that. They're not. They're also looking at right to death kinds of things, and just a broader perspective than maybe a pro-life perspective has been in the past. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I love through my research of CareNet. And I'll be honest, before you had opened my eyes to CareNet, I hadn't known about it. I honestly hadn't, even though I knew that I was anti-abortion, I hadn't fully processed, okay, so what is it that I think about pro-life? Like, where do I officially stand? But through this process and even just exploring, just having that own personal conversation, which, by the way, a lot of millennials are having that same conversation mm-hmm. right now. And they're interested in, hey, can I process this with you?
They want that conversation.
They want it. They want to see it happen. They want to be a part of it. I lost the conversation with the question with the rabbit trail.
Well, because they look at pro-life as a larger conversation
yes.
than just a baby, a mom, and a dad. They're looking at quality of life.
Yes.
They're looking at things like right to life issues, mm-hmm. and we're seeing that.
Yeah.
I know it's terrible, but we're seeing it here in the U.S. now.
Yeah. And I think, again, it comes down to what is the major narrative you're seeing in culture? Mainly driven by art, entertainment, the news, mainstream media, whatever you want to call it.
The culture wars.
The culture wars.
Yeah.
And that narrative, in a lot of ways, presents, again, just these two poles, these two extremes. And it's almost like for the millennial, when you hear that, hey, yes, the pro-life movement, yeah, I'm with that. I'm not about abortion, but ooh, you're not for all this other stuff over here. It almost comes off as hypocritical to the millennial. They're like, you can't really claim to be pro-life if you're not pro all of life. And again, that's one of the reasons what I've come to know about CareNet is that it embraces that broader conversation that needs to be had. Because again, it's all tied together. It's structural. It's systemic. It's not as simple as, you know what, you have the option for adoption. It's much more in that conversation. And again, I won't presume to understand the full mind of a woman. I love my wife, and I still am learning new things about her every day. But the things that weigh on what you're going through, what you're feeling, and what you're having to wrestle with as you look to make that decision, millennials are saying, we know that all that is happening, and that there's all these other structural systemic things that are weighing in on that. And by the way, it doesn't stop once the baby is born. So the conversation can't naturally stop after, okay, cool, the mom decided to give it up for adoption. Great.
Then what?
Then what? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, what about that child that's living in the inner city? I live in Philadelphia, and I'll be blunt. The school system stinks. It's horrible, the public school system there. Mm-hmm. If I'm pro-life and I'm not concerned about changing the school system, to fixing it, to making sure that every child has access to education that will give them opportunity, how can I truly say that I'm pro-life? As you know, convicted felons are being reintegrated into society, if I'm not concerned about that transition and the impact that they're going to have living in my neighborhood and at the same time helping them become full citizens again, how can I say that I'm pro-life? That's the mind of the millennial right now. It's just like, look, this conversation is multifaceted. It's more than the binary that you're trying to sell me on. And I just reject that. And if that's where you're going to stay, I'm good.
And that will lose millennials
in
pro-life, won't it?
It will.
Yeah.
And I think it is where, and again, same thing with spirituality. They're rejecting the institution of pro-life as much as they are rejecting the institutions
church.
Of church. But that doesn't mean that all of a sudden there are these liberal crazies who want to kill every baby. No, they're still firmly anti-abortion. They're still firmly for, all right, well, I need to build an organization. If there's nothing out there, I'm going to go build it, and we're going to come alongside these mothers. A good friend of mine that I went to seminary with, She has a woman's ministry in New York City, which cares for everything from the single mother or mother-to-be who has made a decision to keep the child all the way through, like, hey, we're going to get you access to education. We're going to get you access to resources. Oh, you need some social services? Cool, let's get you into that. Oh, by the way, we're going to connect you with a church so that you can be served not only physically but spiritually and emotionally. That's what millennials are doing. They're saying, hey, I may not slap the label on it, but that doesn't mean that I've rejected it and I'm now in this other extreme.
It's just different.
It's just different.
Very different. So as we wrap up, I know one of the interesting things, and you kind of said it a few times through the morning, millennials are very interested in owning their own businesses, mm-hmm. wanting to own what's happening. And, of course, that would include nonprofits and ministries and all of that.
Yep.
Tell us about the potential there for millennials.
I think it's huge. In the academic world alone, the research on social entrepreneurship,
huge.
It's exploding. And not even just that, if you read Forbes, Harvard Business Review, there we go. Any of these business magazines, in some way they're talking about the rise of entrepreneurship. And it's really a younger generation that is leading that rise where, again, partially because of their worldview, we came of age in the midst of a recession. The worst recession since the Great Depression. We've seen the still rising increase in student debt. We've seen all these things. We've lived them. We are living them. So if the traditional methods and the traditional channels are perceived to be bad or corrupt or not good for us, then we're going to go do something different. We're not going to just sit there on our butts, even though some of us are going home. I think of the movie Wedding Crashers, probably a terrible example, but the guy's living at home on his couch calling for his mom to get him some meatloaf. Like, that's the stereotype. That's the what's the word I'm looking for? That's the caricature that has been portrayed. But in actuality, we're the drivers of Facebook. We're the drivers of Yahoo, of movements, of creating things out of nothing. And that's not that other generations haven't had entrepreneurship in their blood and DNA either. It's just that because the prescribed structures, higher education, corporate ladder, even the church, religious institutions, because those, again, have been shaped or associated, we create associations in our mind that these are bad things. We're going to go pursue and create new things.
Millennials are creators.
They are.
Big time.
They are. And they're looking for those opportunities. They're looking for those, I don't want to just recreate the wheel. I don't want to just go do what somebody else is doing. I want to be different. Because, again, and this is the narcissistic truth in us, we want to have an impact. We want to leave our mark on this
world.
That's
the term social entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest opportunity for the pro-life movement is that there's things that have yet to be created that this generation, if we give them the tools, if we partner with them to collaboratively build them, they will build things that we've never imagined that will take, hey, there's already 37 states that have begun to put restrictions on abortion out there. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on, again, those things that have not yet been created, the whole conversation will be different. This could be a non-starter because it's just done. They've already, the social idea of, we're just not for this. We're not going the way of Europe. We reject that. No, we are for no more babies being killed. We're for people having access. We're for all of these things. And by the way, we're going to change them in our time.
And millennials can do it.
They can.
With your help. There was a Time magazine article a couple of years ago, and it was on the cover. It said, "Me, me, me," the entitled millennial narcissistic generation who's sleeping on your couch. And then it had this little subtitle that said, "And why they're going to change the world."
Mm-hmm.
And that was really my entree into saying, this is possible. Millennials can do it.
Okay.
I think they can really do it.
Hey, I believe it.
I believe it too.
I think I'm going to change the world.
You are, Arthur. You are.
Thank you.
You are. Gold sticker. I think we only have a few minutes left, but can I tell you that Arthur is my go-to person to understand millennials? And if you really want an expert who's not just a millennial himself, but is an expert in understanding the mindset of millennials, this is a great time to ask a question.
Yeah, 12:30.
All right. Thanks for your presentation. I'm an executive director at a pregnancy center. I'm also a pastor. And part of taking over the executive director role was to connect more with the millennial donors because they think differently. Mm-hmm. The old model of patronage, which is look at what we do, keep sending us the money to the older generations, kind of works. Mm-hmm. But I realized with the millennial generation, that sort of model of look what we do, keep sending us money, is a little bit different. They're more demanding.
Yeah.
They ask more what can we do than what can we give.
Yeah.
Because they want to participate. And also the broader, needing an ecosystem of broader human flourishing, just that we stop abortions, mm-hmm. Even though that's our primary focus, they want... I think in my mind that that's part of a broader ecosystem, a broader narrative of human flourishing that you're kind of tapping into. That
yeah.
We can't do everything, but so we've connected more referral networks. That's part of the more of a communal model of we care about the life issue broadly. Mm-hmm. What sort of pointers do you have as a millennial if you were asking questions about? I'm saying, look at what we do. You should support us.
Mm-hmm.
I guess sort of answering that question because that's, I observe like what's happening and I'm trying to respond.
Yeah.
In some of the ways that you've covered, but maybe more on that, the fundraising, yeah. Even the volunteer system, the old model, because we want to protect the center.
Of course.
We're training. This is our culture. We want to guard that. But millennials come in and they're like, hey, can we maybe do things a little bit differently? And I know the older model is like, no.
My way or the highway.
Policy and procedure manual.
Exactly.
Policy and procedure manual.
Yes.
So sometimes we might quench the creative spirit of millennials to see how we can more broadly care. So I think maybe those tensions, the patronage model as well as the volunteer model of millennials.
So let me see if I got the question right. So the question is essentially, how do we understand millennials differently in light of how they would not only contribute financially to our organizations, but then even better understand what is their mindset in approaching that. Is that
yes,
kind of something?
And then on the volunteer side, those tension points of this is how we do it, and realizing, like you said, in the profile of millennials,
yeah.
We're going to create, we might view them as thorns of the flesh.
Yeah.
Like, stop asking questions and still proceed. Computer guy.
Yeah.
How do we tap into that? So I think, because I'm Gen X, I think I get the millennials a little bit, but, and I know a lot of people here, some are younger than me, most probably a little older, I'm 37. So those tension points I think are real. When I talk to other executive directors of other centers,
oh,
they're feeling that challenge. The millennials, they don't like what we're doing, they're going to go do something on their own because they don't like our model.
I work
and it's almost like an adversarial experience sometimes with the millennials. I don't want that to be the case.
Yeah, I work for a large nonprofit, so I get it.
Okay.
I'd offer that we actually need to fundamentally rethink philanthropy. What does it mean to be philanthropic to this generation of young people? And I'd offer that to a young generation, being philanthropic is not just, hey, let me write you a check. ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, case in point. Yes, people gave 10, 20, whatever, dollars online, but they also went and did something. It might have only been pouring water over the head, but they went and did something. That was their volunteerism. So as we look at... not only engaging, even just cultivating millennial donors, it's really considering it's no more, hey, let me give you this report that creatively and intriguingly gets you to be tied your heartstrings to my mission. It's, hey, come support, but I want to invite you into my cause. And by into, I mean how can you collaboratively leverage who you are, what you are, what you're doing to be a part of that, realizing that, yes, part of that's financial, but it's also, hey, I may be talking about you on social media. It's, hey, I may help you rethink what it means to do the way the processes and things that you're doing based on what I know and what I bring. The volunteerism is almost a part of philanthropy. It's one and the same to this younger generation. That's the concise answer, only because I want to be sensitive of the time. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that helps.
Okay.
I'll connect with you later.
Cool. And I have cards here, so I can be happy to give out cards afterwards. Young lady in the blue?
What question piqued the millennials' interest to get them on board? That were a banquet or an event where we are encouraging them to come join us. What is it that they want to hear as far as reaching out to them and volunteering or staff or in any other capacity on this group? What is it that they say, I want to be there? I want to do that. What can we do to encourage them to come on board with us?
So let me just make sure I got the question right. You're looking at how do we create and structure and verbalize in our events and programming that would actually invite them or engage them, get them to want to be a part of our stuff. I'd say that in a lot of ways, we usually approach it, and by we, I mean even me. So I've got 10 years of as a youth and young adult pastor, and we do what we know and what we've learned and what has been modeled for us. So in many ways, often when we think about creating events, whether it's from a nonprofit perspective or even from a church perspective, it has to be entertaining, right? It's got to have some flash, or it's got to do something that entertains. And I'd say that for a millennial generation, they've been over-entertained. In a lot of ways, thanks to the over-access to information via the internet. I mean, I can find a cat video on anything. So I don't need to be entertained. What I want to know and what I need to know, and I think what millennials are saying is, hey, if you want me there, how will this change? How will this change something? How will this transform? What is the real crux of the matter, the real issue that this is meant to do? Like, I don't need to come to be entertained because, by the way, I can Google anything that you're about to tell me. So don't give me what I can Google. Give me how will this cause tangible, real change? And invite me into the process in a very practical way. I don't want to just come and... I'll be the first one to tell you, and I'll leave it to other millennials in the room to say whether or not they agree. I'm tired of conferences.
Are you tired of banquets?
I'm tired of banquets. I go to those things now more to connect with the people around me than I actually do. I usually don't even go in anymore. I just sit outside and just talk because it's. I'm looking for, like, hey, what are you doing? You're over here. It doesn't matter if you're in the next neighborhood next to me. You may be states away from me. Thanks to technology, we can connect and we can do something together. I want to know you and what you're doing and what God's created uniquely with, because then I can think through, well, God created me this way and He called me to do this. These are how these things align, and this is how we can just transform everything.
So throwing out vision or where we're going, mm-hmm. That's probably something that they would like to hear.
Vision is key. Mm-hmm. So the question, if you didn't hear, was how important essentially is vision? Vision is huge. If your event, if your opportunity, if your program is not casting vision, if it's only stuck on the right here and now, then you may excite them for a moment, but they're not going to stay connected to. It's not only thinking through, okay, so how does this practically apply today, but then how will this practically change what's coming? Does that answer your question? Hold on, let's go to this side just because we got two over here. In the back.
I know you're spot on in everything you're saying. But also, I'm not an executive director who is leading millennials. Do you have any practical tips for motivating and leading millennials on your staff who might be more responsible to a coach mentality as opposed to a boss mentality?
Yeah. Kind of come back to the title of our session here. Wasn't there yet? One more. Hey, there it is. Empowering, but enfranchising. So as a millennial leader yourself, like, it's one thing that you've been blessed with. You know, leading the organization, you've not only been empowered to lead, you've been enfranchised because you are the leader. And it's finding ways, obviously, within a structure, because, you know, we don't want people to just go off doing any old thing. But giving away, delegating responsibility so that they feel not just that they are a part of something, but they are owning something, that they are fully connected to what you're about, where you're going, and that they are a critical piece of the puzzle. I think if we can do a better job of that in our organizations, not just as millennial leaders, but as leaders altogether, that not only empowers and enfranchises people below us to really embrace their followership, leading up, learning to lead from where they are, but it'll further ingratiate them. They will literally dissect everything you're doing and help you think through how to do it better. And they will want to do it, even if they're not even being paid to do it, especially in the nonprofit world. You know, a bunch of us are in a nonprofit. It doesn't pay well. But we're not there because it pays well. We're there because we believe in the cause, the mission, what it's working on, and what it can achieve. Does that answer? You didn't sound sure.
Well, even just in the motivation piece, so I think that idea of delegating, giving ownership is huge. And I think that's a really important piece that we need to do for those who lead. But even as a responding to their activities, and how do we, I've heard that, you know, millennials want coaches more than they want bosses. Uh-huh. And how do we live that out in a practical day by day as we lead our staff? Do you have any tips and tricks on how to do that well?
Yeah, I think it's a fine line to walk, because on one hand you are the boss, and the question was, how do we not just motivate, but how do we walk that line between meeting their expressed desire, which is, hey, coach me, I've got capacity, help me reach it, as well as providing structure because you're the boss. So, again, I think it is walking that fine line. I think that's, again, why servant leadership is so, that's what servant leadership really offers. Because you see your leadership as an opportunity of service. You're there less to be the authoritarian, which is, hey, come follow me, to, hey, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this really well. I'm the guy, and this is, I'm a generalist personally. And as a generalist, I can see how different things connect. So as a servant leader, yes, I may be in leadership, but the boss in me is like, hey, I'm bringing the four of you together. But I know that I don't know what you know, so let's figure this out together, because if the five of us get together, this is going to be really successful, because I see stuff in you that you don't even see. I can coach you. I can mentor you. I can empower you. I can enfranchise you to really live that out while providing the necessary structure so that you don't get off, you know, running down the wrong path. You're not even in the right stadium, let alone left field. My boss and I have this conversation all the time. I'm like, look, just give me the guardrails to the highway, so I'm going to run. Tell me when to get off. Let me know if there's a curve coming that I can't see. But you don't need to tell me which lane to run in. I just need to know so I don't, you know, all of a sudden end up in a ditch on the side. And I think, again, maybe that's just a me thing. I don't want to be over too general. But I think that's what a lot of millennials are saying. Give us room to run, because we're going to help you think about this in ways that you haven't even thought about. You think you're, you know, top 500 now. I'm going to get you to top 100. So essentially, how do we manage the realities of the technology that's available and keep it from becoming a bad thing, but really leveraging it as a good thing? I think far too often, and I'm not saying this is where you are, I think far too often as leaders, as organizations, especially in the church, when we see a cell phone or a young person on a cell phone or on their social media, we automatically think or assume that that means that they're not being productive. And I personally would fundamentally reject that thought.
Is that true with most millennials?
I think so. I think it's true with most millennials because, again, we're the first digital natives. You know, our life has been and continues to be shaped by technology. So the fact that, and I do this at work, hey, I'll be on my Facebook. I'll post a blog in the middle of the day, but I'll be just as quick to work till 9 o'clock at night or answer emails when I get home or work on the weekend. So, yeah, you may have lost 5 minutes from me in the normal 9 to 5, or it might even be a half an hour from me in the normal 9 to 5, but you also gain 30 other hours in the week because I'm so committed to what you do and what you're about, and that's why I'm really here, not because you're paying me a paycheck that pays my light bill, that I'm going to give you my all. And the more that we focus on, like, hey, you know, don't bring your cell phone in here, or don't, you know, make sure you don't be on that, or hey, I saw you posting on Facebook, you know, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, then that actually, I think, does a disservice to what you're hoping you'll get from them. Because to them, that's just like, well, this is, oh, and this is key. Millennials don't really bifurcate their lives. It's, it's all one. I am my Facebook. I am my job. I'm married, so I'm my wife, my marriage. I'm my church. It's all a part of me. So you rejecting one of those is like you're rejecting me. So it's really how do we build spaces that embrace the holistic person that the millennial is, realizing that if they feel fully in, they're going to give you fully all that they are.
So as a leader, that's something we need to do more. And that's the person feel comfortable.
Yeah, it's as a leader, it's understanding our followers better, especially given that there's all these different generations in the workplace. It's how do we lead to the person, not just to the not only to the organization.
So not everybody does what you do as a millennial. I mean, I've been in that
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the funding thing. Tell me, just explain
yeah.
Why do you need to be on your cell phone 24/7 if you're the person at the front door who's doing that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the key to everything is communication.
Of course.
And I understand what you're saying as a millennial, but I'm not so sure that all millennials understand where we come from.
Yeah.
And I think that's where that communication
yeah.
is.
And that's the.
It's about what God's called us to do. And it's
sure.
It's saying to us that the focus of the ministry, if Christ's focus, is not going to be effective.
Yeah.
Having everyone in that ministry needs to be
Christ's focus. Oh, I agree.
And that leader is responsible for setting that stage.
Yeah.
Whether you're a millennial or, you know, a Gen X or a boomer.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult.
I agree. And I think this has to be our last question just because of our time. In no way am I saying that we should only care about the millennial or that we should only cater to the millennial. I think that'll actually do the opposite of what you want it to do. It'll push more of them out the door. There is need for structure, and again, that's where the young lady's question over here, how do we walk that line as boss and as coach? Because, yes, we do need to provide that structure, to provide those boundaries. But at the same time, give them space to grow and figure it out within the organization. So thank you.
Can we thank Arthur for his expertise?
Can we thank
Arthur.
Kathleen as well?